That's an Aerosmith reference. If you're down with that, just push play. Just press play.
Did you ever play the Aerosmith arcade game, arcade cabinet, back in the day? Like where you shot like albums at people, and it was all, and like they kept making cameos. Like they would pop up, and like there'd be like Aerosmith like playing on a stage while you were like shooting the bad guys. I can't remember. I think it's like Revolution. It's like Revolution X or something like that.
I'm planning a cold open next time.
No,
I'm planning a cold open next time.
Ah, that's an awesome arcade game. You're the one that brought up Aerosmith.
Welcome to the Voyage Podcast, a show that traverses the oceans of myth and legend through the lens of Catholic theology and philosophy. Come aboard as we set sail in pursuit of the heroic life and Christian virtue with your hosts, Mike Schramm and Jacob Platty.
Anyway, so I want to tell you...
Start your episode. Let's get
this party started. A telos as old as time. Let me tell you a telos as old as time.
Wow.
We're going to... We're going to talk about...
But is it as old as rhyme?
Well, that's a song as old as rhyme, so it's...
Well,
it's a song as old as rhyme.
You know what? I'm sorry I don't watch Beauty and the Beast as much as you do, Mike. I actually really do like that movie. I can't even...
Yeah, I was
going to
say, it's like, are you going to like... Yeah, are you going to like knock on
Academy, Academy Award winning? I think it won the Academy Award. I think it might be...
Yeah,
one
I can't remember
animated...
if it won or was nominated, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Anyway,
the live action remake.
I mean, I could take it or leave it. It's the original is the only one that I like.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's like all the live action remakes. They're all just unnecessary. They're superfluous. Like, what do they add to the experience?
The Jungle Book live action. I'll give that one a pass. The Jungle Book live action. It's
because you're such a Jon Favreau fanboy.
After Mandalorian, I'm not so sure anymore, Mike. But it's a great marvel, like a visual marvel as such, you know, bringing those animals to life. But they also bring in more from the original Jungle Book. In other words, it's an adaptation.
Oh, they try to bring more of the book
in.
Yeah,
they actually have more of the book in there than the original Disney animation. So there's a couple reasons why that one's actually pretty good.
So just to circle back to my really clever pun, I said it's a telos as old as time, because what we're actually going to be talking about, and we're going to relate it to stories. So we'll talk about, you know, because one of the big things that a lot of people will talk about with their favorite movies or TV shows or novels too, but is if it had this big, not just twist ending, but satisfying ending. And the word telos, as we'll kind of get into in a little bit more detail, it refers to the end of something, but we don't just mean chronological end in terms of like, you know, beginning, middle, and end. And it has this word for a reason. It's also referring to not just when something happens, like it happened at the end of the story, but what was the entire story leading to? What was it ordered towards? That's
kind
what
of a purpose.
In philosophical language, the word telos means... or the word end means, is not just what happens after the middle or after the beginning and middle, but what did the beginning and middle, what were they made for? What were they ordered towards? And obviously you can see this in stories, right? Which is why we either really like the, you know, the twist endings, they can sometimes just be there for shock value, but they can also, you know, if it was unexpected, but also really satisfying, those are the ones that really sit with you and why they're so important when it comes to stories. So first, I actually wanted to kind of, you know, just get the ball rolling a little bit. What were some of your, either growing up or even now, most satisfying movie endings or TV show or book endings? What do you
know? I just the other day, I watched The Mist with my teenagers. Now, my
the Stephen King adaptation, right?
The Stephen King adaptation. Do you know anything about this movie? Have you seen it?
So I know the premise.
I
remember reading about it, but
it's one of those things where like you shouldn't have the ending spoiled for you at all.
Okay.
And I can't necessarily recommend everyone go watch this movie. I will say that if you are a glutton for punishment, if you are a glutton for something that's going to really just kind of like kick you while you're down, then go watch The Mist. Mm-hmm. That being said, it is one of the just most unforgettable endings that is, it's in keeping, it serves its purpose. It's a quote unquote good ending. It is not necessarily a satisfying ending. It is not necessarily something that's going to leave you with a warm fuzzy, but it's an ending. All right. Well, boy, howdy.
So we're going to get into, because I know you use the word good purposefully, and that's what I want to unpack a little bit, because you did make the distinction. And I do want to be clear about that too, is that good doesn't necessarily mean, happy or good feeling, and neither does satisfying. When I say a good ending or a satisfying ending,
it's like a deserved ending.
It doesn't, it's like not necessarily attached to an emotion. Now, maybe the emotion will flow from it because you recognize the good that's in the ending, but it doesn't have to be synonymous. And and I know that's what you were trying to kind of parse out a little bit too. And I think it's important, whether when we're going through our examples or when we break down the word telos or end later on too. So, so you got the Mist, which, kind of a horror movie, but then has that sort of like thriller or kind of shock ending to it as well. I'm going to go a little bit happier. Did you ever grow up reading or then watching the movie, the Danny DeVito Matilda? You remember the...
I do know what you're talking about. I've seen the movie. Okay. It wasn't like on my playlist very much when I was a kid, though. So like, I don't have like a deep familiarity with it. No.
So there again, it's one of those where it's good in the sense of it's happy and, you know, emotionally it checks all the boxes, but it definitely is fitting for the characters. And there's a strong sense of justice at the end of the movie too. And so there's kind of the that's where the satisfaction maybe comes from a little bit.
I mean, I could go all day. Yeah, I mean, I could go all day on these. Like, there's so many movies that are like really, really well loved. Are well loved because they're ending. And honestly, I don't know if we're gonna get into Game of Thrones during this conversation, but an ending can break.
I wasn't
break
even
a,
trying to go there.
An ending could break a story too, right? Like how a story comes together really matters, and it will color the entire experience, right? So if you get like a powerful ending, it can really solidify what came before it, or it can rescue what came before it, or it can destroy what came before it. But like, you know, I think like a movie's like The Godfather, you know, like that's a movie about basically an innocent man who falls into corruption. It's kind of like Breaking Bad. Kids, let me tell you what The Godfather is.
I was going to say Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
I was going to use Breaking Bad as an example.
Oh yeah, well no, that's an ending that's like really, really profound, right?
And it's considered not just by, you know, like not just two people's opinion, but I think pretty widely considered one of the best show endings or series endings as well.
Mm-hmm. The Godfather has a great kind of like subdued ending to it, you know. I brought up Cabin of the Woods a little bit ago, and that's got an ending that is pretty good for that movie. I had some other ones too. I mean, there are some things,
Say Lord of the Rings. Say Lord of the Rings. Just do it. Just say Lord of the Rings.
I was going to say some movies have many good endings, like Lord of the Rings, that has no less than like 5 good endings. So sometimes the director's just like, why choose? You know, we're just going to throw all the endings that we could have in that. But that is good. You know, the way that, you know, the nice thing about Lord of the Rings, the way that it ends is it's almost like an extended ending. Not just in a punny way because of like how many endings the movies have, but I'm actually talking about the book in that case, where like the end of that novel, it's almost like classical in the sense that, like, you know, when we were growing up, we were taught that the climax happens in the middle of the book and then the resolution is just like everything that happens afterwards, right? And nowadays we think that's like the climax is the last 5 minutes of a story and then there's like a 5-minute resolution. But in a more kind of classical motif, it would be more like just like exploring the ramifications of what happens. Lord of the Rings does that. Lord of the Rings has a long, lengthy resolution. And, you know, it allows you to kind of like breathe and kind of like see the fallout in a really satisfying way, right? So that's a good example of a good ending.
Another one too, which I actually didn't initially put on my list, but I think if you kind of go into what we're going to go into in terms of what makes it an end, the end of something, and you've already kind of touched on some of them, but a really great example where you can see so many elements in the beginning of a story and how they are brought to their fulfillment at the end is the Harry Potter series. If you so much of book one, which, you know, you have to think that if book one had not been successful, then 2 through 7 would have never come out. And so she had, you know, Rowling not only had to make book one good enough on its own to become popular on its own, but also to have all of these little things planted in there that would eventually come to fulfillment in the 7th one. And they're ones that
one's fantastic.
Yeah. It's kind of blink and you miss it details. So, and it, like I said, especially in book one, I mean, not that the 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 don't have elements that lead into the next one or lead into, you know, a book, 2 books down, but you really have this sense of when she wrote one, she had 7 in mind already. Mm-hmm. And so it's where you can tell that, you know, when an author has thought through everything, then he or she has, they've thought of the end so that all of the foundation, all the pieces at the beginning can be ordered towards it. And that's exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about Telos, is
Harry Potter's
everything at the beginning. Yeah. Everything at the beginning has to be directed towards. Now, we don't see how it is if you just read book one, but, or if you just watch movie one, you don't necessarily recognize it yet. And that's what makes it so satisfying, is you were just along this journey and then your eyes are opened, right? The veil is taken down so that you can see how all the pieces fit together.
I have a really good trilogy of films that exemplify how this can play out.
The Matrix.
It's all M. Night Shyamalan. Okay. So when M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, I've heard this. Go ahead.
When M. Night I'm just making this up. So if I'm agreeing with somebody else already, then or whatever. But like when M. Night Shyamalan first came on the scene in 1996 with The Sixth Sense, I mean, it's a trope now. It's tired. Everyone knows the twist ending on that. But that was a big deal back in the mid 90s when that movie dropped. And he was he was the next Steven Spielberg. It was mind blowing. Everyone was like, you have to see it. Don't find out the ending. Just go see it, kind of thing. And it worked really, really well. Like Discovery. I'm going to spoil it because, I mean, this is a cliche.
It's been
right?
over 20 years.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that Bruce Willis is dead the entire time. He's a ghost, and the I See Dead People kid is like actually helping him process his grief as a ghost and not the other way around, right? Because he plays a psychologist trying to help a kid. He doesn't realize he's a ghost, finds out he's a ghost. Anyway, everything about that movie, though, and that's what's great about these types of twist-type movies, where when they're done really, really well, you don't pick up on the hints, but then once the twist happens and you rewatch it a second or third time, you see all the hints and you see all the evidence in plain sight.
All the breadcrumbs.
Yeah. It was all just there in plain sight, and you just didn't see it coming, right? Great example of a perfectly plotted, played out movie with an awesome end. The next movie he did after that was called The Village. And The Village is the opposite of this, kids. The Village, which I guess I'll go ahead and spoil that one. It's not as much of a cliche or as well known as, but for the sake of this, you know, tutelage, I guess I'll just go ahead and break it all out. You know, that one takes place in old times, and they're all in a village, and they all speak like bad old English. It just doesn't work. But it turns out at the end, they're not in old times. They're actually in modern times, and they belong to a village that's like cut off from everyone in the woods. And the whole movie is about them not going in the woods, because the stories are don't go in the woods, but it's to protect the people from finding out that they don't exist.
Going out into the real world.
They're not. Yeah. That keeps them away from the real world. Right. None of that's earned. None of that's earned. None of that. It's just a twist for the sake of a twist. It's just like, whoa, crazy. It's kind of like it was all a dream, kids. Like that whole like.
That's when he sort of became a parody of himself. I think that was the turning point, because that wasn't the direct movie that came after Sixth Sense. Like he had had Unbreakable, he had had Signs, but then it was at The Village where
I think it maybe started to become. Was it? Okay. Signs is where I was going to go next. Signs is somewhere in the middle of those two.
Yeah.
Unbreakable is really good. So Signs is the in-between example here. So you have an example like The Sixth Sense that's like perfectly plotted, perfectly breadcrumbs, perfect payoff ending. The Village is just like the rug gets swept out and it's just kind of like, okay, I guess. And then Signs, he does have all these elements throughout the film that are leading up to a like really, really intentional conclusion, right? And it's really, really good in a lot of ways. It's just the problem with that one is the ending just doesn't, it's just not quite the clean, concise, basically aliens can't touch water. Right, just to spoil that one,
swing away.
Well, there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, but this is the problem with the ending is like it's just kind of a bad ending. Like the plotting's good, the breadcrumbs are good. There's the swing away reference is a reference to how they end up like kind of like beating the aliens with a baseball bat when they find their weakness, kind of thing. It's better in the movie. Honestly, it's a good movie. I like Signs a lot, but the problem is. That's a silly ending. It's silly that the aliens can't touch water because they came to a planet that's 90% water in order to enslave people. In other words, if your ending like raises so many questions, it doesn't matter how well it was done up until that point. People are going to walk out of that theater being like, that was a weird end. That was a goofy end. That wasn't good. So
that gets into the plotting, the satisfying part.
But the ending sucked, right? And then like so case one, the plotting's great, the ending's great. Case two, the plotting sucks, the ending sucks. Example three, the plotting's great, the ending kind of sucks, right? You got to get the telos to match the story.
It's a spectrum. It's a spectrum, it sounds like, right? There's a whole M. Night Shyamalan spectrum.
There's the M.
This was not going to be an M. Night Shyamalan episode, but I guess that's the direction we're going.
Well, hey, as long as we stick the end, as long as we stick the end on this podcast, Mike, you know
this
what?
Is all ordered towards something, isn't it? Yeah, so I don't know if hoping. I kind of want to do a little bit of background in terms of the just what is... Telos, what is end? And I've already kind of gone into it a little bit, maybe spent a couple of minutes, but it's referring back to, you know, it's not all Plato, Jacob, okay? A little bit is Aristotle. So we got Aristotle's four causes. And basically, it's this whole idea of whenever you ask the why of something, you can get four different equally sufficient answers. And the first is the material cause, right? So when you say, like, when you try to discover what something is or the why that it's there, you know, well... Why like, is that? That
if my one son pushes because, my other son down, the material cause is that he pushed him. Right. If I walk into a room and the kid's crying on the floor, and my other kid's right there, and it's like, what happened? You know, why is he crying? Like I pushed him.
His hands made contact with the other one's body with force, and you know, gravity took the person to the ground. Like the most kind of straight mechanical
dominoes.
Explanation. The formal then is asking the like, well, not just what is it made of, but what is it? And you could say in what shape it is or what configuration that contributes to the form. That's not all that a form is, but we can look at two pieces of wood in a room and say one is a table and one is a chair based in large part because they can both be made of wood, but based in large part because of their form.
Right? It's within my child's nature to fall when he's pushed. He does not have anti-gravity mechanics. So there, he fell because if you get pushed, you will fall because that is your nature.
What is your form. Newton's laws, right?
Yep.
Newton's laws of motion. And then there's the efficient where we're talking the, you know, what put that thing there? Why is that thing there? Well, because the carpenter built it, right? Or why did Johnny fall to the ground? Because Billy pushed him, right? So now it's focusing on the agent, or there's the efficient cause.
So then, the older brother who pushed him is the efficient cause.
Now, the all three of these are all ordered towards this final cause. So going back into any of those examples, when I try to build, you know, a table out of wood and not marshmallow, it's because of the final cause of a table, which is to stand upright and to hold things on it. Wood is going to do a better job than marshmallow is. Because I build it in a certain shape with a flat surface and not a, you know, a pyramid surface, that's going to serve its final cause of holding stuff on top of it so that it doesn't fall down.
Or my son pushed the other kid because he wants the toy the kid had. Or he wants to beat him to getting a toy. So,
or the other kid pushed him first, right?
Or the other kid pushed him first or something like that. Yeah. Why did it happen? So, because of this type of end result.
So all three of those, and I say this, I do it like this on purpose, is because everything else, the first three, you can answer a lot of questions by those first three. And go back to our example of a story. You can answer a lot of questions about a story with the material, the formal, and the efficient cause, right? You can almost say like the formal cause is like the genre. Is it a horror movie? Is it an action movie? Is it a comedy? The material, right? You're not just dealing with like what is film made of. We're talking, you know, the actors and actresses. We're talking about the script, the setting, whatever. But they all are ordered towards this end.
Would the efficient cause in that analogy be like, I don't know, like the producers or something like that. I don't know. Like,
or yeah, if you want to say the person who kind of brings it all together to like put it into a structure, into a narrative structure, right? So if I'm the director and I'm saying this act is going to happen before this one, or the scene's going to happen before this one, and I'm doing that with a purpose, right? I want to show the audience that you open the briefcase and the light comes out, right? Mm-hmm. To make it important to the audience, because I have something in mind at the end of the movie. You know what I'm referencing, by the way? Yeah.
That's a Pulp Fiction reference. I was thinking about making that joke because it was such an obvious reference that I was going to joke about it. But then you had to ask me. Then you had to ask me if I actually got the reference. Come on, Mike. Jeez.
You know,
I was going to say
we've never talked Tarantino movies. We always like, I don't think we've ever talked about any Tarantino movies, so.
And this is a movie, this is a podcast about, you know, Telos and Good Ends. Kill Bill would be a very good two-part movie series that raises a lot of these like purposeful endings and things like that. It has a really good ending to it and things like that.
I mean, but I think Tarantino, you know, just because, and people look at his movies, his films, right, as very artfully made. I think he incorporates a lot of these things, you know, whether it's on purpose or accident. I'm not saying that he's thinking of Aristotle when he, you know, makes his movie, but he's definitely thinking of every part in his story is going to serve the end, right? Even
you know
if it's
what?
Nothing more than just to misdirect you.
No, even if it's not real. All right, so let's just go there because this is fascinating. I think it's worth it. He has made more than one film now that are historical epics based in history where he ignores history. He just ignores.
He makes myths.
All know.
He's a myth maker. Yeah.
Well, so, you know, Inglourious Bastards is one. And the other is
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in both cases, he ignores the historical truth in order to give an ending that is better. Like he wants to give a better ending that serves the purpose of the story and serves a satisfaction within his audience that is better than what happened in real life. And he does it, like you said, because he himself is like, yeah, I make myths. I make stories. I don't need to pay attention to how Hitler goes out. I can make it up. And you know what?
He's not
going
to slave
to
this brutal
ending.
Historicism. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm going to give a better ending. I'm going to give the ending that I want to see, right? Mm. And usually is thematically satisfying to the context of the story that he's created. So both those films are fascinating. I mean, honestly, the first time I saw Inglourious Basterds and the way that movie ends, I was like, you can do that? Like, that's, I didn't see it coming. I didn't know okay. that you could just ignore history. Like,
yeah.
You know, like you can just like, and we're all going to be okay with that. It's like, yeah, I guess we are going to be okay with that. Like, all right, you know, golf clap. Like, yeah, that's how it should have ended. Or how it should have ended. That YouTube channel. How it should have ended. Dude.
Yeah.
Those are hilarious videos. Well done.
Yeah.
How it should have ended channel.
And there again, that whole mindset can exist because our minds are ordered towards, right? Whether we like it or not, whether we realize it or not, they're ordered towards this telos. They're ordered towards this. And now we can disagree about what's more or less satisfying or why my satisfying ending is better than your satisfying ending or whatever. But that doesn't deny that there is this objective standard of end itself, right? Now, again, to some degree, because I make up stories and you make up stories, there is that subjective element, but it flows from the objective reality that that a story is ordered towards, right? A satisfying end, and I mean satisfying in the purest sense of the term. And where does that come from? Or how does that relate to God, right? Now, we talked about Aristotle, we talked about the four causes, but there are two, I think, pretty interesting and pretty overt references to revealed theology, to Christian theology, that I kind of wanted to go over. Is that all right with you, Jacob?
Oh, I guess I'll allow it.
It serves the end. So I actually just came across this recently. I was reading it was by a Western Catholic theologian, Jacob, but it was on deification and grace. Deification and grace. Daniel Keating. And he was going into Matthew 5:48, which is the line that Jesus says, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And if you're just taking a kind of modern understanding of the word perfect, that can be a very anxiety provoking verse. You're like, wait a second,
moral.
I have to get 10
you
out
think
of 10
like
on
moral perfection, right? Like that's kind of like,
it can create the scrupulosity is a word. But actually this is taking off of, I'm not a Greek expert. I didn't go, but the word perfect is teleoi, which is where we get the word teleos. And so when he says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect, he's saying it in terms of be ordered towards the end, be ordered towards the kind of the goal that you were made for. So there again, it's not just a comforting verse in the sense of like, oh, good, I don't have to get 10 out of 10 on all my quizzes anymore, or I don't have to worry about, you know, making a mistake. It's actually redirecting your mind to, well, what was I made for, and am I ordered towards that goal? Am I ordered towards
that purpose?
It's almost like
be properly organized in your life.
Yeah.
You know, have like the right orientation kind of thing.
And so that I thought was really, you know, like I said, the Daniel Keating, deification and grace, but he's referring to Matthew 5:48, which is the Sermon on the Mount. So it's Jesus's huge discourse on, you know, just the Christian life, basically.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, I'll just quick comment on that. Like, I say this to my kids fairly frequently because I have kids that are getting old enough now where, you know, 16, I have a 16 and a 15-year-old, and 18's right around the corner, college is potentially right around the corner, and they have a lot of anxiety. They have a lot of anxiety about the future of their life. And I don't think it's just them. I think it's like this whole generation lives in a weird time, you know, where social media has made everyone like real mimetic and competitive with each other, and not just like in a kind of like superficial sports competition way, but in like, I need my life to look good. I need to like be successful, right? And I can see other people who look successful, and they're going to see whether or not I look successful and all that type of thing, right? But then also you have like a lot of like automation happening, a lot of like turmoil, and then a lot of these kids, they just don't really have, you know, the same idea. Like, I'm going to grow up and be an astronaut. I'm going to grow up and be like president of the United States. They're kind of more jaded, let's say, than like maybe earlier generations were. And they have this like sinking feeling where it's like, I don't know what I want to be. I don't know what I'm supposed to be. I don't know like what's going to make me successful in life. They just have all this anxiety about that, right? And I see it in my kids and I see it in their friends. Honestly, I just keep telling my kids, you know, those are all details that will sort themselves out. You should just have a proper organization to your life, an understanding of your relationship to God, and an understanding of your relationship to your community, like where you live and your family, right? As long as you are properly oriented towards God and your family and the world around you, what you do as a profession shouldn't be nearly as important as those three things. And yeah. I don't think they get a lot of like solace from that. You know, I don't think that like super satisfies them. It's like their boomer dad answer, I guess. But mm-hmm. I think that's the answer because frankly, their anxiety is well. Yeah. You know, I understand
tie back
it,
to,
stuff like that.
Tie it back to our example of a story, right? Where it's like, if you're the author and you know what your goal is, then you know, like the details in terms of how you get there are going to be less important than that final goal. As long as you keep your eye, your mind's eye focused on it. And mm-hmm. so it's the same thing. You know, I know that again, we've talked a lot about how this whole like kind of deconstruction and, oh, we're not heroes on a journey and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, there are forces.
Review that YouTube video.
There are forces trying to deny that. But even if you just said, well, let's just pretend for a second that you are a character and you're in a story, then you are ordered towards an end. And, you know, the details that you come along the way, yeah, things can try to thwart you, but ultimately it's pushing you in that direction, you know?
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
I know this is us kind of working through our kids are getting older. Oh, wipe the tear from our eyes.
Find it to be, I mean, I think it's,
It's cathartic to talk this out, isn't it?
Well, yeah, no, that's true. I was going to say it's cathartic to understand that, like, whatever, if I lose my job tomorrow, right, that would be a big problem for me and my family. That would not be okay. Right. Like, but the larger purpose of my life and the larger end of my life is not the particular job that I work at. Mm. And I have a certain level of peace and a kind of safety nets, not materially. I would definitely don't have one materially, but spiritually there's a safety net. There is a source of calm that stems from understanding that like I am not defined by my job. And I am not defined by like what I think I should be, right? Outside of the context of like what my larger purpose is, you know?
Well, and I mean, to say like this is applicable because this is the classic like male midlife crisis too, right? Is the sense of being untethered, the sense of being disoriented, not having that thing that you are ordered towards or moving towards. And when you, and the midlife is when a person actually like sees that, you know, they're not so busy that they actually recognize that. And it can become, you know, a crisis. It can become that thing that like, just like completely throws you off for, and you know, many people can end up ruining their lives because they don't have that sense of, well, do I have the end in mind? Do I see the end that all these little steps are ordered towards?
Right. Right.
So not only do we have, I mean, as if the Bible wasn't enough, as if the Gospels weren't enough, there's actually a Thomas Aquinas reference to teleos, his fifth way. So Aquinas has these five, you know, arguments for God's existence. And the fifth way is the one based off of the end, that basically everything within creation is ordered towards an end. So, you know, I mentioned the thing about the table, right? The table is ordered towards holding things on top of it. Now, those things could be, you know, briefcases and business papers, or it could be dinner plates and food, but it still has that purpose or that end. Well, everything in creation.
This is like C.S. Lewis. This is like C.S. Lewis's little hunger exists because food exists, right?
Yeah. Like, so, I mean, so if we can apply that logic to everything within creation, then, you know, no part is greater than its whole. Then you have to apply it to all of creation itself. So all of creation itself is then ordered towards an end. But here's the thing. The end has to be outside of the thing itself. The table is ordered towards, you know, the holding up of food for dinner time. The purpose is outside. So
tables don't
way,
serve other tables. Tables are not made for tables.
Well, and so the cosmos, right, all of creation, if it's ordered towards something outside of it, that means that there's something outside of creation, which, and this is Aquinas' language, which everyone would call God or refer to as God.
Now and I feel like I should create like an apocryphal Far Side comic strip where there's just like tables seated at a table.
It's tables all the way down.
Yeah. Maybe that's
something
what
like
it
that.
Is. Yeah. It's tables on top of tables on top of tables.
So it's a, I mean, this idea that we, you know, it's not just in stories, but it's significant that it's in stories because it relates to all of reality. And so, you know, I kind of said the example of, well, if it's in every novel we read, you know, let's just, for the sake of argument, pretend that we're a character in a novel, right? We're ordered towards, now it doesn't mean that we're ordered towards slaying the dragon and rescuing the princess, right? But then again, you know, metaphorically speaking, aren't we all sort of?
True. My son brought up the other day, like, what's the point of Sleeping Beauty? Like, what's the moral of the story kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And I think that shows preconditioning on his part that, like, every story is supposed to have some kind of, like, Aesop's fable type moral to it. But B, it did get me thinking. It's like, what is the moral of the story of Sleeping Beauty, you know, if there is one kind of thing? I actually think it's more about Prince Philip than it is about Princess Aurora.
You have to go on Jonathan Peugeot's...
maybe he's got a better explanation for this. Yeah, right? Well, like, or maybe Jordan Peterson can explain it to me. But, you know, he has to go slay the dragon. He has to go cut through the thorn forest. He has to go, you know, all that stuff. Princess Aurora is probably, like, the princess with, like, the least amount of agency in, like, all of the Disney canon. I love that movie, man. I am not knocking that movie. That's one of my favorite movies, actually. But, yeah, she doesn't necessarily learn a lesson.
You're just a toxic male, that's why.
I'm drawn towards the one where the prince has got the story arc.
Where she just lays there.
She just lays there. The prince. Oh, boy. Good movie. But anyway, he has to go fight the dragon. That's the point of that story. Mm-hmm. Is Prince Philip has to go fight the dragon. So sometimes your story's ending might not even be about your main character.
I thought you weren't even going to bring up that it was like, doesn't he have like the shield of virtue or the sword of virtue or something too? I thought it's a pretty dense metaphor. Yeah. I think the, you know, not just the filmmakers, but the storytellers knew what they were doing when it came to that one.
But, true.
So we went through tell us a little bit how it relates to stories, how, you know, and then obviously, I mean, the Bible itself is supposed to be one big story, and you can see how it's ordered towards the end. And this is where it's kind of important. You mentioned the thing before, how the climax isn't supposed to be in the last 5 minutes, right? It's supposed to be in the middle, but then everything else is the resolution and the picking up of the pieces. And this very much fits in with the Christian story, with salvation history. Right, where we're living in the resolution, we're mm-hmm. living in the picking up of the pieces. The battle's already been won, and so the end, in a sense, in terms of what all of history is ordered towards, has already been achieved. Even though we're not chronologically at the end, right? The world isn't over yet, or time isn't over yet.
Well, you know where we are though, and I know we're not supposed. These are supposed to be timeless episodes, but I'm going to break that rule again. We're actually recording this in a season, at least in the Orthodox Church. I'm sure it's relatively true of the Catholic Church. You tell me. It's the end of our liturgical calendar, right? Our liturgical calendar is about to reset in September, right? And we're recording this at the end of August. And the last few feasts, the last couple feasts in our calendar are the Dormition of the Theotokos and the Transfiguration of Christ. And so... go figure, the Lord Spirits podcast, we got to name drop them every other episode at least.
One of us does.
Yeah, that's true. Where do you think I get my extra paychecks from?
Oh man, you're making H&F money?
What are you doing? I'm a shill, just not for Voyage. In case you haven't figured that out already, I'm a sleeper agent.
We'll remember that when evaluations come due, when employee evaluations come up.
But anyway, they did a episode on the Transfiguration in the context of their End of Time series, because the last like few episodes have been about like the end, you know, the end of time, right? The apocalypse.
And that's so just as a quick, I guess, you know, rabbit trail a little bit. That's, you know, I've always had a fascination with the Transfiguration because in the context of the story, it never seemed to quite fit. I was always like, what's the purpose of the transfiguration?
Exactly.
But it's precisely, and this is why it makes so much sense. I'm not that the, you know, Lord of Spirits needs a pat on the back from me, but it's because it's showing you the end that Peter, James, and John and all of us are ordered towards. And so that's what made it so important, is that they could see, in a sense, their destiny or their end or their purpose, so that they could, because that's what we need to see as we're fighting this, walking this Christian walk.
Well, and to tie it back to some of the things we were talking about when we were talking about like M. Night Shyamalan movies, it's almost like a hint, like you don't understand it in the middle of the story. When Jesus goes through the transfiguration, it's not obvious like why that's there at that time, right? But by the time you get to the end of the story, it all makes sense, right? Or at least once it's kind of properly explained to you anyway. Because I'll be the first to admit that I didn't quite get it. I didn't realize I didn't get it. I just thought it was kind of like an episodic thing that happens, you know, like sometimes the gospels are just kind of episodic like that. But the transfiguration is in fact not just arbitrarily random. You know, it actually has a very important place right prior to the move to Jerusalem, and the passion that follows and the resurrection that follows that. But also the fact that it ties into the end of human history as such. And it's an example of what the glorified humanity will look like, right? And he's giving that up front to his disciples so that they can hold on to it through all the pain and suffering that's to follow, kind of thing. What I was actually going to bring up when it came to the transfiguration stuff and the Dormition fast, and the Feast of the Dormition and things like that in August, I always thought that it was kind of just like weird placement, because normally the liturgical calendar does have this cyclic and kind of like natural storytelling flow where in September, and again, I can only speak for the Orthodox Church, but in September...
I'm actually you when you're done.
yeah, go for it, because I'm curious. I actually don't
quite know what the liturgical New Year is a little bit different. So yeah, go ahead.
Okay, all right. It'll start with the main big feast that starts the year is the Nativity of the Theotokos. So you actually have the story of Mary being born and things like that, and then there is the finding of the true cross, which is a big deal early in the church year. But that's more of like an after gospel history type situation.
September 14th, right? That's what it is for on the West too.
I'm sure. I don't know if it's the 14th or not, but it's somewhere in September. But anyway, but it starts with Mary being born, and then it's going to go to Jesus being born, and then it's going to go to Theophany or the baptism of Christ, and then it's going to go to, and like you're following this obvious story. And then, like, Jesus's crucifixion and resurrection at Pascha, and then Pentecost, and then, and again, we're all chronological. Everything's more or less chronological, except for the finding of the true cross, but that's kind of like this historical thing. But you're following the chronology of Mary and Christ, their lives. And then, of course, it ends with Mary dying, or Mary being assumed, right? Like, the end of Mary's earthly life, right? And that makes sense. And yet there's also the transfiguration there for us. And I always thought that the placement of the transfiguration being there, because unlike the true cross being found, which is a historical reason for when that feast is, the transfiguration, it seemed to me, well, that's based upon the narrative of the gospel. So why is the transfiguration not sometime in February or something like that?
Lent or something right before
why is it like not the week before Palm Sunday or something like that, you know, like whatever. I'm still thinking this kind of chronological thing.
Yeah, but you're living in Kronos, we're living in Kairos, baby. That's what it is.
Well, I was always okay. In fact, I thought that there was something symphonic.
You were obedient to it. You were just curious. Yeah.
Well, and I always just told myself, well, you know, it's just kind of the sense of like a leitmotif. Like there's something beautiful about like the symphony of the liturgical calendar and how different elements can be kind of time displaced and all that. So I just kind of assumed that was all there was to it. But now I realize the transfiguration is really a celebration of like the final purpose of human history. Mm-hmm. And it suddenly feels very thematic to have it in August, right in around the same time as the
and Mary,
you know, end of Mary and things.
And her Dormition and Assumption, she's, even though I know that Jesus is the first fruits of it in terms of humanity, but she would be the first fruits by the order of grace, right? So we'd say Jesus's resurrection and ascension into heaven are by his nature as the second person of the Trinity, as God's son. But Mary, we would say, is the first person in the church by the order of grace to have received, you know, that assumption into heaven that we all look forward to at our own resurrection and, you know, our bodies and souls reunited and general resurrection, all that stuff. So yeah, no, that's the, definitely some fittingness to that. So where the, just to kind of piggyback a little bit, and then we'll kind of go back into our, go back into our outline a little bit, is so
the end the Western Church of this podcast. Yeah. Your outline.
The Western Church. So our liturgical year ends at the end of November, right before Advent. And it's at that time where you'll get a lot of readings that have to do with like Jesus's prophecies about the destruction of the temple, end of the world. I think the last Sunday of the church year, we read Matthew 25, the separation of the sheep and the goats. Hmm. And it's also the feast of Christ the King, which was a special feast. I think it was only implemented like maybe 100 years ago. I can't remember which pope it was, if it was Leo the 13th or whatever, but it was kind of in response to a lot of the changing political systems. I think it was even like during the, you know, kind of rise of communism and Marxism and stuff. And it was just reminding everyone to whom we are all subject to whom we are all ordered towards. And that, you know, Jesus Christ is obviously the King of the universe. And so kind of using that as like, this is what our whole church year is ordered towards in terms of this is where it ends.
Well, right? Also, I just want a quick note.
Being subject to
that reminds
Christ.
Me of what I was talking about, like the kids, where it's like, you know, you're just talking about it at this like big macro level. And basically the Catholic Church is like, let's remind ourselves, like, no matter what the world looks like, no matter like where your political alliance is, no matter what country you live in, Christ is the King. He's the true Lord. He's the true purpose, right? It's kind of just a macro version of how I try to soothe my kids' fears, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no. And I mean, so it's a, and like I said, it's a relatively newer feast day, I think, or maybe it was just reorganized recently. I can't remember. But and so, like I said, that's the end of November, because then Advent is the start of the new church year, usually the first, you know, week of December, first Sunday of December.
So. Do you guys, I mean, I know this is getting off topic here, but do you guys have a big, you know, formal feast for the
Christ the King? Right.
No, of the Theotokos' birth and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, like,
the birth of the Assumption. So the birth is September 8th, right?
Okay. It's on the
calendar. It's not a solemnity like the Assumption is. So the Assumption is one of the like 5 or 6 holy days of obligation, where even if it's on a Wednesday, you know, Catholics are supposed to go to Mass or whatever. So like that was just last week, right? Hmm. Last Tuesday, I think, the 15th. So like I said, that's the, and then the Immaculate Conception, which is December 8th. Oh yeah, that's why I know it's September, because a conception is December 8th and then the birth is 9 months later, September 8th.
So, I see.
Yeah. That's why the Annunciation is March 25th, 9 months later, December 25th.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So, it's not a solemnity, but it's a feast day. So it's kind of one of those things where it's like, where does it fall in the tiers and all that stuff? But all right. So we talked about how telos relates to God. What about to humanity? And, you know, going back, because Aristotle is the one who really talks a lot about this final cause. He refers to the final end of humanity, interestingly, as contemplation, right? Which in a sense, from a pre-Christian pagan point of view, that kind of makes sense, because like that's as close as you can get without grace, is just the contemplation of God, right? As best as, you know, in his case, it'd be the unmoved mover. But Christianity, it doesn't deny that. It yes ands it. It takes it a step further, because, you know, in the Western tradition, the language for the life of heaven is referred to as the beatific vision. And the language of beatific vision, it comes from this root of Aristotle's contemplation, right? Because when you're contemplating something, what are you doing but you're seeing it in your mind, right? It's a sort of vision, but it's not just the physical vision that you
have. I'm rusty on this, but like, you know, people use contemplation and meditation interchangeably a lot of the time. Like go meditate on something, go contemplate it or whatever. And I do think that they're closely related in like what they're trying to convey, but there is a difference at least in the roots of those words and like where they came from. Mm-hmm. And this is where I'm rusty. I'm pretty sure meditation has to do with breathing. It has to do with like, I think it has to do with whispering like the words, right? So like if you're like studying, you know, back in the day, they would like read softly to themselves, you know? And so like people would be kind of like whispering. And so it's like the breathing of like engaging with something while you're reading it kind of thing. And that's kind of like where meditation, the word comes from when you're meditating on the scriptures and things like that. Contemplation though has that word temple in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
Contemplation means that you're becoming like a seat of the divine. Contemplation means that you're becoming like a holy indwelling kind of thing. I'm pretty rusty on both those words. So if I'm wrong on that, whatever, take a drink. But like, ever since I started editing these episodes, that's the new, that's the new drinking game. I am so wrong so often.
Well,
all the things I say with such confidence.
It fits with the inspiration because this was supposed to be, so maybe the next time we all hang out at the bar, you'll see me in the corner taking shots. Cause I'll be like, oh, what is Jacob wrong about now? So
yeah. You could get a pretty good drinking game out of it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, contemplate. I do know temple has to do with it. I do know that that is, it comes from serving in the temple and things like that. And so there's something quite profound about this idea of contemplation. And obviously within the Christian tradition, heavily related to a deep prayer life and whatnot. And both our traditions have the idea of vision, of seeing God, right? I think there's a little bit of dispute as to what we mean by that. But I mean, at the most basic level, we're basically saying like, you know, having this vision of God, this vision of Christ.
Yeah, well, no, and I mean, again, when I say something is you know, metaphor or spiritual or whatever, like even the idea of vision, it implies an understanding of something. And so now you know, when we think of meditation and contemplation, we think of it in terms of thoughts, right? You are turning a thought over in your mind, you're reflecting on it more, you're thinking of it in other ways, right? You're trying to, wrap your head around it, so to speak. But what you're actually doing is you're participating in the truth of that thing, right? The more angles that you can see or the more facets you can see on that diamond, you're participating in the more extensive beauty that that diamond has, or the more angles that you can see or the more perspectives you can see that novel from, you're seeing the truth from all these different angles. You're participating more fully in it. Well, now we're talking about not just another true thing in reality, but the source of all truth in reality. And so you're going to endlessly participate in it. And like I said, if we think of something as holding it in our mind or seeing it with our mind's eye, that's where the vision or contemplation sort of ties in.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, what does that mean for us in the world? You know, like, because I associate that, A, with death, right? Like, you get that, I think in most cases in the Catholic Church, like, you get that, like, upon death, right? You know, like...
Your life flashes before your eyes, right? Yeah. And it's supposed to be all of those things that brought you to where you were.
Well, but then I was talking about, like, the vision of Christ, too. The other potential opportunity is to have a mystical vision of Christ, you know, through, like, prayer in some monastery somewhere or something like that. But like, can we take a lesson from our purpose in life? And if our purpose in life is to see God, to be a friend of God, to have a vision of Christ, right? We know that one day we'll be like Him, right? As St. Paul says, and we'll be able to see Him, you know, as He is, or however that's phrased, right? Can we work that into our lives? Can we work that into finding our purpose, you know, as we go about our business, because I'm not in a monastic cell all day, just like saying prayers, you know?
This is actually where, you know, I'm glad you bring that up, Jacob. This is where
I had a feeling
when it comes to, cause again, I don't want to be one of those people who like takes himself too seriously when it comes to stories. Like, you know, you mentioned Game of Thrones before, and it felt like they got a little heavy handed when it came to their role as story makers. If you remember those last couple.
The biggest mistake you ever made was bringing that back up. Cause I had totally forgotten.
But anyway, so this is actually because when we usually when people talk about like how stories train us to live, right, they're thinking primarily in terms of morally, like you are going to be nicer to people because you saw how justice turned out in this character's story, right? Which, I mean, that's perfectly fine and that can work too. But what the more important, I would say more fundamental ways that stories train you is when you see how, when you read good stories and how things have that satisfying ending, because all of these things were put in here for a purpose to serve this final end, it will train you to see your life in that same way. You will understand your life as these little things are here, not just so that I can grit my teeth and bear it and, you know, show off that I went through this tough thing and I walked to school uphill both ways in the snow. It's more, you could see how these events in my life were ordered towards this final end or final cause. And that's what's so destructive when, you know, we mentioned before the kind of deconstruction that happens when people will talk about you're not a hero on a journey, is when you are left with no end, no possible end, then your life, then you can't see how anything in your life has meaning.
Yeah, and at best you can try to ascribe meaning to it, but I don't think that works
well. You can't fool yourself. You can't fool yourself that well. So you need to see, goes back to our table thing. The table's purpose has to be outside of the table. It has to be ordered towards, now you could say materially it's just ordered to hold plates on top of it, but we know that a meal is much more than just food on plates, right? A meal is about, even a meal itself is ordered towards bringing loved ones together, sharing the love that went into making that meal and spending the time together, spending the attention, you know, sharing the attention. So it's the same thing when it comes to, if you recognize in stories that these things are supposed to be ordered towards an end and see when it fails, but also when it succeeds, right? You are conditioning yourself to see everything through that lens. And this has nothing to do with, you know, reading the Bible more or less. I mean, obviously it's good to see because you can see in those stories how they're ordered towards the end, but we're not even there yet, right? In order for the stories in the Bible to even make sense, you first have to see how stories themselves are ordered towards this final cause.
I think that it gives you an amazing amount of like elasticity in life. And adaptability. Mm. And I think this is what Christ refers to when he talks about his burden being light, is that everything, you know, when he says, don't worry about tomorrow, you know, he's referring to the freedom that we have, the liberty that we have to not get bogged down by the details of this existence and to have a proper understanding of what our grand and ultimate purpose is, where our ultimate home is, and understand that, like, none of that's here. And, you know, whether or not I'm a shoe salesman or a, you know, rocket scientist, like, those are just details, right? We're here to kind of bring God's glory to those professions. I'll say that much. You know, you have the opportunity to bring your purpose into the job that you do, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's meaningful. That's satisfying, but we're not tethered to anything here, and our sense of failure should only ever be seen in the light of like Christ, and it shouldn't be seen in the light of like who we are on this planet, you know, what type of job we hold down or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, I was there was one more thing when it came to like this theological idea of exitus and retitus and how it fits in with story, but I feel like that might deserve its own. We did talk a little bit about it in episodes 2 and 3. So I like how, you know, I feel like this came to a fitting end. I feel like we definitely had a, you know, a very climactic moment and got a little excitable or whatever. But now, you know, we're landing this plane, right?
we're coming to the end.
We definitely showed how, like, you have to have that end in mind in order to make everything else make sense. Now it seems counterintuitive because it's like, well, wait, I'm right here in the moment. I'm going through, you know, this year, I'm going through my whatever 25th, 30th, 50th year. But I hope this isn't the last year. I hope this isn't the end. And you're like, no, it's not about, it's about looking towards the end because it's going to make you, you know, more present. And like you said, it's recognizing who you are, not as your profession and even not primarily as your familial relationships. Right. But it's first and foremost your relationship with God. And then that's what allows everything to fall into place. It was, you know, to kind of go back to one of our first examples, it was like, it was only when Harry Potter recognized the idea of the Deathly Hallows and the Horcruxes that he could see all of these other things in the previous six books make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there you go. I guess that's what there is to say about that.
See, and you got all tired now too. You're like really mellow. You're like, I'm going to end this day.
I am mellowed out. No. Yeah, it's true.
I want to thank you guys for coming to listen to, again, just some of our thoughts and ideas on stories in general. You know, we talked a little bit about some specific examples. I think maybe our next one, we should do a specific movie. How's that sound?
Ooh, I like those ones. Yeah. Hopefully they're popular. Sometimes I worry that
your movies from the 70s that you always choose?
Yeah, I know. It's like, maybe people haven't seen this movie. Maybe they don't care about this movie. Huh.
But yeah,
what a novel
thank
idea.
Thank you guys. And again, we ask you to, like, subscribe to the show, share the show with people you think might be interested who like, you know, thinking about these stories a little bit further, leaving a 5-star rating and a positive comment to, you know, make Jacob feel better about his beard. Cause he talks about it all the time off the air.
Is that the end of the show? Game of Thrones sucks.
Thanks for listening to Voyage Podcast. The Voyage Podcast is a production of Voyage Comics and Publishing, which seeks to create exceptional entertainment informed by Catholic values that inspire people to live a heroic life. Voyage Comics seeks to advance truth and beauty found in powerful stories. To learn more, visit voyagecomics.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram